I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. State police have chronicled an increase in reports of hate crimes in Maryland. In Prince George's County, a white University of Maryland student has been charged with a hate crime in connection to the fatal stabbing of a black Bowie State student back in May. Swastikas carved onto desks at UMBC. The N-word painted on dorm rooms across the country. Bigotry is alive and well in the ivory tower. Lawrence Ross is the author of Blackball, the Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. Ashley Vasquez is a student activist at the University of Maryland. They join me to talk about racism in higher education. Plus, a new exhibition at the Maryland Historical Society juxtaposes the old and the new to understand race, gender, politics, and Maryland's social landscape. Midday starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you've chosen to join us here on Midday. Welcome. Last week, Sean Urbanski, a white former University of Maryland student, was charged with a hate crime in connection to the fatal stabbing of Lieutenant Richard Collins III, a black Bowie State University student. Back in May, Lieutenant Collins was stabbed at a bus stop while visiting friends on the University of Maryland campus. The entire incident was caught on camera. Prosecutors plan to seek life without parole if Urbanski is convicted. His trial is set to begin in January. At the time of the alleged murder, it was reported that Urbanski was a member of an online hate group that posted bigoted messages and memes called Alt-Reich Nation. Authorities say further investigation into Urbanski's cell phone and social media accounts uncovered evidence that suggested that the murder was indeed racially motivated. Following this heinous incident, the University of Maryland held a memorial service in honor of Lieutenant Collins and released an action plan, which included an additional $100,000 for the school's Office of Diversity and Inclusion, as well as a new rapid response team when hate-based incidents occur on campus. Tragedies like the murder of Lieutenant Collins in College Park and the murder of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville in August are indicative of an increase in racism and bigotry that is being displayed on and around college campuses across the country. In the last few months, swastikas were found on the campuses of the University of Maryland Baltimore County, the University of Maryland College Park, and Georgetown University in Washington. Bananas and nooses were hung on trees on the campus of American University last spring after an African-American student was elected SGA president. This fall, Confederate flags were posted on billboards around campus. At Boston College, racist flyers were found hanging on the campus, and last week, three men were charged with shooting at students who were protesting alt-right leader Richard Spencer's appearance at the University of Florida. In the first month of school this year, the N-word has been painted on black students' dorm rooms at several schools across the country. Lawrence Ross is the author of several books, including his latest called Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. He joins us today on the line from NPR West in Culver City, California. Mr. Ross, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ashley Vasquez is a senior who's studying sociology at the University of Maryland. She's a member of Delta Sigma Theta, and she serves as the president of the school's National Pan-Hellenic Council chapter. She's also a member of Protect UMD, a coalition of organizations that represent minority communities at College Park. Ashley, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to join our conversation about racism and bigotry in higher education and beyond, our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Ashley, we spoke with you and Lawrence Ross last June following the death of Lieutenant Collins, and we said we would follow up on this story as things progressed. So that's what we're doing today. The latest development is, despite the Prince George's County State's Attorney saying as recently as last July that she found no evidence of to justify a charge of a hate crime, they have changed their mind and they have decided, in fact, to charge Sean Urbanski with a hate crime in connection with Lieutenant Collins's murder. What's the reaction been on campus to that news?
As far as administration, we haven't really heard anything on their side, but on the student side, all we can do is, you know, praise the state's attorney's office for finally, you know, doing what's right and charging Sean Urbanski with a hate crime. Back when this murder happened in May, our police department was very quick to say in the gate that this was a hate crime from the get-go. Although students protested and people came out and said, well, we need to take a look at this because it is a hate crime. And, you know, now that they've come out and said, hey, you know, after further investigation, more evidence has come to light that it is a hate crime, students are finally a little bit more on ease with our police department in Prince George's County because they've, you know, finally let this new evidence shed in light to change their minds on the case. Like I said, again, we haven't really heard anything from administration, and I don't think that we will per se.
Is there a sense that, I mean, Mr. Collins was killed at the very end of school. I mean, exams had ended. A lot of folks weren't on campus anymore. Memorial was held. You know, some other things happened over the summer. A task force was established by the school. But now that everybody's back on campus, the incidences of bias and hate and bigotry have not stopped by any means. What's happened in these first few weeks of school this year?
So in the first couple of weeks, there have been a lot of isolated incidents that have been occurring on campus. I know, you know, the first couple of weeks of school, we had swastikas found in dorm rooms. We had the N-word written across places on campus. Just about a week or two ago, one of our esteemed African-American professors, he received a very, very derogatory voicemail about 10 minutes long, and all the university did was, you know, say that we have to express our sympathies to him, but nothing else. As far as swastikas found on camp on in dorm rooms, you know, the whole dorm wasn't even alerted, only the floor on which it happened, and the campus only found out through our campus newspaper again. And these are just, you know, isolated incidents again that have happened, but they continue to happen every week. It's something new, you know, swastikas found, the N-word is drawn, you know, someone has a racist remark towards somebody else. So although, you know, we did end last semester with memorials and, you know, observances and things like that, things really haven't changed, unfortunately. And I know it's going to take some time to implement some of those, you know, the acts that we've talked about in the last semester, but as far as, you know, incidences happening, it still seems like it's on a sudden increase.
And Lawrence Ross, you chronicle in your book, you know, numerous incidents of hate and bias on college campuses. And one of the things you point to is a reluctance at the very least, a huge divide, a racial divide in people's understanding and acknowledgement of the scope of the problem. There are a lot of school administrators who will simply say that the problem, you know, these incidents are isolated, they're infrequent. But if you're a student of color and you're living on a campus like American University and you walk past billboards where, you know, 2 weeks ago they were posting Confederate flags, it's a very different situation. Talk about that, what appears to be a pretty huge divide in terms of understanding the scope of what's going on.
Well, when it comes to race, and particularly systemic racism, Americans have a great ability to be selective amnesia. When I was researching Blackball, one of the things I found was that, and I think I mentioned this in June, was that there was nothing more consistent on a college campus more than racist incidents. They were as consistent and as ubiquitous on college campuses as college cheerleaders at a football game. And what happens oftentimes is what I call three I's equals a miss. Basically, what happens is that people are continuously shocked that a racist incident occurs, and they immediately individualize it by saying, oh, well, this is just an individual incident. Then they tend to minimize it by not wanting it to have a consequence or be attached to other racist incidents that occur on the campus or, say, for example, within the higher education. And then they trivialize it. They'll say, well, perhaps the students are too young or they're immature, or they were drunk and they didn't really mean it. And so what that tends to do is that tends to dismiss the concerns of minority students who basically tend to continuously get the message that they don't belong on their campuses. And so you see this in a number of different areas. There's a disconnect, for example, where there were approximately 250 campus racism incidents during 2015. And Inside Higher Education magazine did a study called a racial climate study with about 700 different campus presidents, college presidents, and asked, what's the racial climate on your campus? And around 90% said either good or excellent. Now, they had another 200 or so campus racism incidents in 2016. They went back to those college presidents and asked them what was the racial climate. And the number is still around 90%. And the number of excellent people who said excellent went up. So there's a disconnect between what colleges and universities think about race and racism. Actually, it really mirrors American society in terms of, for example, the Prince George's County initially thinking that it did not have anything to do with race is kind of the default response that people have, is that you have to really go through a high hurdle to be able to say something is connected with race, even if it is on its face connected with race.
And Ashley, the university issued a statement. We asked for a member of the Department of Diversity at the school to appear in the program. And for the second time, they've not been able to provide anybody to speak with us. They did send us a statement, and they referred to things about the task force that they have established. The task force is in the process of, you know, collecting data, and they are going to submit a final report by March coming up in 2018. They talked about the rapid response team for hate bias incidents, and they talked about issuing this annual report on hate bias incidents. They referred to the fact that Congressman John Lewis spoke to the students about these issues a little while back. And again, they mentioned the fact that they've increased funding. And they have, of course, appointed a new director of diversity and inclusion, Dr. Roger Worthington, who is evidently highly respected by people in the campus community. But, for example, when this incident happened in the dormitory, they told the folks on the floor that it happened, but they didn't tell the people in the rest of the dorm, and they certainly didn't tell the campus-wide community until it was published in the Diamondback. Why is it important? Why do you think the university should have let everybody know immediately after this happened? What would that accomplish?
Well, the thing is, when you don't tell the university students as a whole, it seems like you're trying to hide something. And when you're trying to hide something, then you're making it apparent that you do have a problem with racism on campus, but you don't want people to know. So one of the reasons why it's so important that whenever an incident like this occurs on campus to alert the entire community is because, you know, you want to say, this happened, this is how we're handling it, and, you know, this is what we're doing to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And by doing this, you're letting the university students know that you care, that it's not that you want to ignore the fact that there's racism on your campus, but you want to let them know that we're seeing it, we're getting on top of it, and we're going to make sure it doesn't happen again. When you don't tell the university students that happens, then you get the kickback. Then you get students saying, you know, well, what are you trying to hide? You know, this is just one of the most important pieces in putting an end to racism on our campus, is communication from our university that they do see it and they do care. Because if they don't, they stay silent. They kind of give the wind to, you know, the other side, to those who are going out and committing these crimes of hate and racism. You know, by not saying anything, they're kind of saying it's okay to keep doing it.
And Lawrence Ross, just this month, in the last, you know, 6 weeks or so since school started early last month, a black student at Cornell up in Ithaca, New York, was beaten by a group of white men, and they used racial slurs during that attack. A black student at Cabrini University in Pennsylvania had the N-word written on her dormitory room. Another student at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville had the N-word written on his campus apartment door. It happened at the University of Michigan, another N-word incident. One at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Iowa, one at Westfield State University in Massachusetts. I mean, these are not isolated incidents. These are happening everywhere. Atlantic Magazine had a piece a week or so ago that wondered whether or not it would affect black students' willingness or interest in attending a so-called PWI, a predominantly white institution. You travel all over the country talking about this. What are the kids telling you? Do you think there is a growing reluctance to attend not an HBCU?
Definitely. I just actually 2 days ago I finished speaking at Washington State, and one of the president of the College Republicans had traveled to Charlottesville and was one of the people named James Alsup, if I remember correctly. He was there was a photograph of him in Charlottesville with as a neo-Nazi, and so a lot of the students were thinking, like, I am living in Pullman, Washington, which is pretty isolated, like most college towns that are kind of like land-grant schools. And I'm basically living with a person who is a neo-Nazi and a person who wants to denigrate me. So why should I make a decision to leave Seattle to Spokane or wherever to come to this place where I don't feel safe? And don't forget, remember, you also had the student who was arrested for saying that he was going to kill students at Howard University, and he thought that it wasn't murder because they were black. So in Blackballed, I talk about the fact that, and I said this, you know, basically a year and a half ago, that there was going to be a tragic incident, mainly because predominantly white institutions don't take this seriously. We're coming upon Halloween, and every Halloween, every Black History Month, every Martin Luther King's birthday, every Cinco de Mayo, you have white students on college campuses deciding that they're going to denigrate students of color. It happens every single year. And it's not something that universities should be surprised at. Now, in terms of whether or not African-American students are going to go to these schools, well, we also have to remember in a macro level, African-Americans have been breaking through barriers in terms of schools that were desegregated, you know, in terms of like 1963 with University of Alabama and the like. So this is not anything new in terms of confronting racism on college campuses. It's just a new version of it. This is just a millennial version of the baby boomer and the Gen X version that occurred before. So black students will always go to these schools, but whether or not it's really upon the predominantly white institution to figure out whether or not they're actually creating an environment that is welcoming and inclusive for these students who come there. They deserve that.
Lawrence Ross's latest book is called Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. Ashley Vasquez joins us as well. She's studying sociology at the University of Maryland in College Park. She's a member of Protect UMD, a coalition of 25 student organizations that represent 8 minority communities at College Park. We'll have more after the break. You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, to join us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, where things stand at this juncture in the healthcare debate. Open enrollment begins next week for the ACA. My guests will be Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News and Joseph Cantos. He's a healthcare expert at the American Enterprise Institute. So we will revisit the complexities of a very complex subject, healthcare. That's tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about racism on college campuses. I'm joined by Lawrence Ross, the author of Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. Ashley Vasquez is a student activist studying sociology at the University of Maryland. She's also a member of Protect UMD. That's a coalition of organizations that represent minority communities at College Park. You're welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday at wipr.org, and our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. So Ashley Vasquez, the Maryland State Police have just issued a report about hate incidents across the state, not just on campuses, but across Maryland for 2016. There were 82 more incidents reported this year or in 2016 than in 2015. November, for some reason, appears to be the month where most of the reports happen year to year. 93 of these incidents have been verified, meaning they've definitely qualified them as hate incidents. Most of them occur in Baltimore County, Montgomery County, and Anne Arundel County. There were only 7 reported here in Baltimore City. I say only 7. 7 is too many, but still it's the fewest number of any municipality. Most of the offenders are white males. What can, you know, for example, when it comes to something like this rapid response team, what is your suggestion, Ashley, for the administration at College Park in terms of how to deal with expressions of hate and bigotry on campus? Tell us about an incident that happened just a little while ago where some people were appeared to be white supremacists who were protesting on campus, and how the police and the administration reacted.
So a couple weeks ago, in front of our SAM Student Union, where our food court is located and a lot of students congregate, out front there was a small group, about 5 to 6, who appeared to be students, very young, like in their early 20s, and they were protesting. They were white nationalists. They had posters, and they weren't necessarily attacking anybody, and no one was either even giving them the time of day. But when the police were alerted, they came and cordoned them off. So we gave them a space to, you know, continue to the chant and say what they wanted. But that was kind of it. The police didn't do anything else. And I'm not saying the police had to drag them off or anything like that. But I do think that that's an instance, especially after Charlottesville, of alerting the campus community of what's going on in our, you know, in our own community. Unfortunately, in Charlottesville, we saw that, you know, people lost their lives. Heather was tragically murdered, and, you know, people were injured just because of a neo-Nazi rally. And these small groups of people, although it may have only been 5 of them, who's to say that they wouldn't have cried in the act of violence? So in speaking about this rapid response team, something that hasn't been initiated yet, but in that scenario, the university should have sat down and said something. As far as our rapid response team, like I said, it hasn't been rolled out yet, but when it is, that top piece is going to be communication. Communication to the students, because we are their priority. Terps that step on this campus, anyone that steps on this campus, their safety is the school's priority. So whatever we need to do to protect students, faculty, staff, visitors' safety, that's what we need to do, especially when it comes to rapid response.
And Lawrence Ross, you've written about the general reactions that occur from administrations across the country. It's not unique to the University of Maryland, certainly. And you say in your book, no more conversations, no more town hall meetings, no more white papers. The era of gradualism is over. We need to take proactive and not reactive measures. So what are those measures? What should administrations like the ones here in Maryland be doing?
Well, yeah, I was just thinking about that when we were talking about the rapid response. It's basically a game of whack-a-mole. It's one thing that, of course, an incident occurs and then you respond, but if the incidents keep occurring, it's like trying to fight cancer by just, you know, nailing down the tumors. But you have to go at the heart of the cancer. And the University of Maryland and all college campuses need to make sure from the very DNA of who and what they are that they are emphasizing from the minute that a student decides to apply to their school until the minute that they actually graduate, that they emphasize that they're going to be an anti-racist university, meaning that diversity and inclusion is part of the track in terms of graduating. Oftentimes what happens is that universities will do things like have an orientation where they will talk about racism and sensitivity and bigotry and things like that, and then that'll be the last thing the student actually hears about it, or that the consequences for being racist or attaching racist ideas to things, there is no consequence. Universities have to move beyond that. Universities have to make a stand that is not a PR stand that's right in the middle. They have to be able to figure out that if we're going to be part of transforming a world, We're part of transforming young adults who come to our campus from various parts of the country and various parts of the world. Then we're going to also have to make a stake and say that being anti-racist is part of that. Too often, the reason we have to remember why racists target college campuses. Racists target college campuses and target minorities because they know universities are the one place where America gets changed. So you can be educationally changed, economically changed, and sociologically changed by getting a degree. So if I can prevent that, then I can make sure that the America that I don't want to happen doesn't happen. I can discourage those people from happening. So as a university, what you're going to have to do, for example, I think UCLA has started to implement a diversity track where you have to take, you know, ethnic studies course and a women's studies course and an LGBTQ course. Doesn't matter if you're in physics. You know, it's not just on the liberal arts side. You have to incorporate that within your curriculum. And when you're able to do that, then you're able to break down. And then you're able to have conversations, the ones that I don't want to have inside of in my book, but real conversations within the classroom where you're able to get out aberrant ideas and replace those ideas with ideas that are actually genuine or that aren't antisocial. Let me say it that way.
Yeah. And Ashley Vasquez, what do you think about that as a student, rather than just a presentation at an orientation in September, actually requiring people to take courses in this area as a requirement for graduation? How's that strike you?
I think it sounds great. Actually, some of the students on the SGA here at Maryland that I also serve on are trying to implement this. So we have a course called University 100 in which most freshman students have to take in order to graduate. And we want to implement, you know, this type of diversity training in these classrooms. So like Lauren said, no matter if you're a physics major, if you're in engineering, if you're in business, you have to take this course. And this also stands because now the university is taking that extra step, that extra initiative to make sure that you are now focused, and this track is no longer going to be just a PowerPoint at freshman orientation that nobody watches, but now it's going to be not only for a grade, but really integrated into our culture here to make it known that the university is now taking a proactive step in racism and not a reactive step.
Of course, university officials have to deal not just with students, but with people from the community, people from outside the campus at College Park. The police there at College Park have charged a former employee, a man named Ronald Alford. He's 52 years old. He lives in Hyattsville, and they've charged him with malicious destruction of property because he's alleged to have painted swastikas on maintenance carts near the dining hall. So you've got people outside of the community as well. I think, Lawrence Ross, one of the other reasons that white supremacists and their ilk target college campuses is because campuses tend to be places where free speech is honored and respected and elevated. Richard Spencer has said this in numerous interviews. He's a white supremacist who was behind the Charlottesville situation, and he was just down in Florida. He says, we want to go to college campuses because, generally speaking, they will let us come and talk because of their value of free speech. The whole free speech thing does play into this quite prominently. I mean, you yourself have been embroiled in some controversies regarding your right to speak and your right to characterize President Trump.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And remember, I tell people I'm an alum of the University of California, Berkeley, the home of the free speech movement. So I know, you know, free speech, but I also tell people that free speech is not a freedom from the responsibility from what you're actually saying in terms of the in terms of what your responsibility. We sometimes talk about the particularly the First Amendment as being, you know, sacrosanct, but without saying about what is the other side of it. For example, I talk about in Blackball the fact that white fraternities, predominantly white fraternities and sororities on college campuses for decades would discriminate against African Americans and minorities in terms of joining based upon the First Amendment right of freedom of association. Now, they had the freedom of association, but the result was discrimination. The fact that you have freedom of speech does not necessarily mean that you don't have the ramifications of that speech. Now, when we have freedom of speech and these students and Richard Spencer coming on campus, yes, the way to counteract that is with other speech. But the problem is that if a university doesn't also, as Ashley was talking about, recognize that the students of color who are basically under assault and typically are at very low numbers have to have the backing of a university, or they need to make sure that their speech is amplified in a way that is equal to the speech that is trying to denigrate them, then the students of color will appear to be under assault. And actually, I'm funny that you mentioned mine. I was at you're referring to me being at Campbell University. And one of the students at Campbell University, is a very kind of conservative.
In North Carolina, right.
Mm-hmm. In North Carolina, a small conservative university in North Carolina. And one of the students was the president of the Students for Trump. And he had taken objection to some things I had said about Donald Trump on Twitter. Fine, no problem. What was funny is that there was this notion that I was coming on campus and talking about anti-racism in college on college campuses, and that it wouldn't be appropriate on a campus that had voted for Donald Trump. But the funny part was that after the lecture, everyone all came up and they said, we didn't expect what we expected. Mainly because when we're talking about anti-racism, you have to make a moral choice, and you have to understand. That's the reason why my lectures are called Know Better, Do Better. You have to understand the macro, you have to understand the micro, and where you sit with it. And when you're able to do that, then you're morally, within that speech, you're morally obligated to make a choice.
Lawrence Ross is the author of Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. We're also speaking with Ashley Vasquez. She's a student and activist at the University of Maryland. So, Ashley, when it comes to free speech in these issues, for example, just these last few weeks at the University of Louisville, also at Stockton University in California, at Purdue University, white supremacists and white nationalist groups posted posters all around the campuses. I'm not sure if anything specifically like that has happened at College Park. But if that's the case, I mean, if you're a student at American University and you walk by a billboard or a bulletin board that has cotton sticks and Confederate flags, is it not the right of the person who posted those things to do that under the First Amendment?
So, at College Park, we have had those. But back in early of last semester, we did have posters by white nationalists hung around campus. They said things like, if you see an illegal, quote unquote, call this number to have him deported, and things of that nature. When it comes to the First Amendment, like Lauren said, you do have the right to free speech, but when that free speech causes discrimination, causes an act against a minority, well, then that's the problem, right? And that's where things like this get a little tricky, because to someone, the offense of may not be taken, but to another, they might read these things. They might see, a poster with cotton on it. They might see another poster that says, take action. And then they might go and take that action. And then that's where we have to draw the line. So when, these posters are posted up on campus, I think, again, that's where the university comes and says, hey, this is free speech, but we condemn it. We're going to allow it. We condemn it. And action should not be taken on these posters. And that's just for the protection of the students. So these posters that are unfortunately hung up not only around colleges' campuses, but across the nation right now, we have to be very vigilant and careful, because although we do not want to hinder anybody's First Amendment right, we also don't want to allow it in which it then turns into an action against another individual.
And can I ask one thing to this also?
Sure.
If you notice that you're seeing, particularly with Charlottesville, more overt white supremacists who are deciding to come on campus. And what they're doing is kind of clever, because it reminds me of what that old cliche of the bank robber talking about, why did he, rob banks, is because that's where the money was. A lot of the overt white supremacists are dressing like people that you would see on a college campus, trying to set themselves into the bloodstream of the college community And so trying to normalize just an idea that being a white supremacist is just like anything else, is just like being in any type of club, which really harkens back, if we talk about white supremacy, to even the establishment of the Ku Klux Klan. Did Ku Klux Klan try to imitate the idea of being a Greek society in terms of being a legitimate Greek society? So the more things change, the more things kind of stay the same.
Ashley, what's your understanding or your assumption about the role that President Trump plays in the increase in racial bias incidents, not only on campuses, but across the country since his election? The Washington Post said that since his victory, his meanness has been infectious. Do you think that the fact that the president is not above bullying statements and brutish statements on Twitter and elsewhere against various people of all races and genders plays directly into white nationalists and white supremacists feeling more emboldened these days?
I think it does, 100%. As you said before, you know, we saw a spike in November of hate crimes, not only in Maryland, but probably across the nation. And when you have, you know, the leader of the free world tweeting at people and making these racist remarks and saying these sexual gestures, then the people who voted for him are going to do the same thing. For example, I was raised very conservative household, and I grew up in the era of Obama. And what did I do? What did my political beliefs change to? Into what, you know, what I saw in his presidency, what I liked. And that's what people are doing. People who voted for Trump, people who are supporting him, are going to do what he says. And these, you know, these white nationalists, people who are out here committing acts of hate, they are going to go support it because their president is basically doing the exact same thing. So they don't see any remorse. They don't see any consequence.
And I think it's very important for us to, I'm not a very big supporter of euphemisms. I don't think this just meanness or just kind of a tone. President Trump directly speaks to white supremacists. He directly makes a decision, and every president always has to make choices about who they support and who they don't support. So, for example, I did not vote for W. I did not vote for George W. Bush. But George W. Bush, after 9/11, specifically went to a mosque in order to talk about the fact that we should not have as Islamophobia or things or hate crimes directed toward Muslims. That is a value. A virtue. When we're talking about President Trump, we're talking about a person who makes no bones about the fact that he does not see white supremacy as being wrong. And when that comes from the top, you're of course going to have an energized base of people who will take that and run with it.
Lawrence Ross is the author of several books, including Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses, as well as The Divine Nine, The History of African-American Fraternities and Sororities. Lawrence Ross, thanks so much for coming back on the show. I appreciate it.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Ashley Vasquez is a senior at the University of Maryland. She's studying sociology. She's a member of Delta Sigma Theta. She serves as the president of the school's National Pan-Hellenic Council chapter. She's also a member of Protect UMD. She's a very, very busy person. Ashley, thank you for your time. I appreciate it as well.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a quick break, a new art exhibition at the Maryland Historical Society explores Maryland's social landscape. I'll talk to the artist and the curator in exactly 90 seconds. Stick around.